Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. On my right is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. And this time I've been looking at episode 14, where we talked about fanzines. That was a long time ago, but fanzines are never too far away from my heart. I think I've said before that I really am a frustrated fanzine editor. And in this episode, we speak to John Power, Jr., who is the editor and publisher of Weird Science magazine. He talks about his ambitions and inspiration for producing a role-playing magazine, as well as giving insight in his background in gaming and beyond. This was a recording that was made as part of Virtual Grogmeet back in April. Also in this episode, I'm joined by Judge Blythe, a resident rules lawyer, as we try and imagine a fanzine of our own, taking us back to 1983 to produce something that didn't exist and still doesn't exist, but it sort of does in your imagination. I'll be back at the end of this podcast to give you some parish notices, but until then, ramblers, let's get rambling. Okay, welcome to Open Box, the part of the podcast where we look backwards to look forwards, how our gaming of the past has informed the gamers that we are today. I'm joined in the Zoom of role-playing rambling by the Grog Squad, as it's virtual grog meet, and by editor, art director, copy editor, marketing manager, publisher, chief cook and bottle washer, John Power Jr. of Weird Science. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And here on my left, I've got the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. Now, John, would you like to give it a tap virtually across the ocean? Oh, and she's appeared as the journalist in Goody Two Shoes, a famous video, of course, with pop star Adam Ant. So there you go, because we're talking about magazines. John, you are an editor at large of Weird Science magazine. How does that feel?
Normally very stressful. And yeah, I mean, right now it's a very odd feeling. So I don't know when people will hear this, but our latest issue just came out about, well, this week, really. So the last month has been a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of stress, a lot of panic, a lot of trying to fix things that inevitably go wrong. And then there's normally a week of sheer terror because, as I say, I do all the graphic design myself and I'm not a trained graphic designer by any measure. So there's always this kind of week where, you know, I've handed over £4,000 or whatever to a printer, sent it off to them, and then it gets back and you're like, you open the box and it's like, what the hell have I done? But it's this time it's all good. So I'm in that kind of weird interregnum, kind of weird space. And I've just started planning the next issue. Yeah, it's a very stressful job, but it's, you know, it's one I stupidly chose for myself. So I can't, you know, it's a bit much to complain, I think, you know.
We'll talk a bit about the experience of producing the magazine and why you do it. But first of all, let's get an understanding of you as a gamer. So what's your history? What was the game that you were hot on when you first started?
Oh, so I think I'm probably like a lot of the people who will be watching this. So I'm late 40s, grew up in UK. So I'm very much... Fighting Fantasy was kind of the gateway drug that got me into this at 6 years old. The weird one is I bought Dragon Warriors, Dave Morris's Dragon Warriors. And I think I was probably about 8 or 9 or something. And anyone who saw it at the time will know it was the same size as it was done like a kind of corgi paperback kind of puffin, whatever it was. So it looked like a fighting fantasy book. So I bought it from a Sea Scout Jamboree for about 50 pence secondhand, and took it home, opened it up, and I was like, hold on a minute. This is, where's all the numbers telling me, you know, how I've died this time? None of that. So I was like, oh, okay, so this is something different. And I never really got to play it, but I read it. But that just completely informed how I thought role-playing games should be, this kind of slightly crunchy, weird, old, kind of low-level sort of games. And then from that, about when I was about 9 years old, my next-door neighbour, we'd been making games. Weirdly, we used to just make games all the time based on, like, we had one or two. We had this game called The Sorcerer's Dungeon, I think. I've actually got a copy. Sorcerer's Cave. I've got a copy of it over there. Some 1970s, very simple dungeon crawler. And so we used to play that. And then, obviously, we'd start making our own versions of it. And, you know, we'd add things. I think we didn't have Talisman, but we'd seen Talisman. So we kind of had this idea in our head of what Talisman should be. So we invented our own version. And so that's what we just used to do. Like, as, you know, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, we just used to sit in our living room, and over the summer, you know, we cut out bits of card and paper and make these little fantasy games. And we had no real kind of knowledge of what it was supposed to be. And then age 10, for the podcast, this would be rubbish, but for people watching this now, I'm holding up issue 81 of White Dwarf, which came out about 1986. And my neighbor got that, and he was like, lent it to me. And it was the first time I realized that there was a world out there of people like us in some ways, making this game. But there are all these proper games out there. And it was just, it blew my mind. You know, I was 10 years old. I was like, what? Oh, this is, I want to dedicate my life to living in these fantasy worlds. And first I read that, and I was like, that's when I became like a forever DM, because I read that and I was like, well, that's the best job. You know, you get to sit here and read all these incredible adventures. And, you know, I was a horribly nerdy kid. I was the kind of kid who, you know, sit him in front of a set of Encyclopedia Britannica and I'd be very happy just randomly learning about weird stuff. So for finding out that you could kind of parlay that aspect of yourself into, oh God, I want to learn about 15th century medieval city sewer systems, you know, and it's like role-playing games are perfect for that, because it both encourages you to be this awful person that's obsessed with, you know, trying to find out every little detail. And it gives you a legitimate way of being like, oh, what are you doing this afternoon? Well, yeah, I'm going to spend the afternoon, you know, looking into the Holy Roman Empire or something to figure out one small detail that my friends who are like equally 10 years old will never ever care about or whatever. So that's kind of how we got into games. We were all just playing them and we're just kind of obsessed with them. And never really Dungeons & Dragons, oddly. I played it once as a kid. We did the Temple of Elemental Evil. So I guess this was AD&D first edition. It was fun. It was fine. But it wasn't. I think all these things are by chance. It just happens to be that someone happens to go to the shop one day and they don't have D&D, but they do have Call of Cthulhu. And so you buy that, and then that becomes, you know, you don't have a million games, you have two or three. So, you know, you buy that. And the games that we were playing was like Judge Dredd, Star Wars, Paranoia, Call of Cthulhu, all those kind of things were just, and Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And at the same time, we were, you know, the perfect age for the all those kind of big box Games Workshop released. So I don't know, it's a bit blurry, but you've got like Blood Bowl second edition and stuff like that up there that you know, you just spend your weekends. Dark Future, Blood Bowl, all those games, Space Hulk, and beautiful time to be like 12, 13 years old, really, the kind of late 80s, because it just, yeah, it was a time of immense possibility, I think, in terms of gaming, but also not enough that you could kind of be bombarded. For me, they got me at the right age. But then, I mean, I fell out of the hobby when I was about 15. Weirdly, the last thing I ever bought was the 5th edition Call of Cthulhu, which is like the only thing I still have from that time. So a few years ago when I was like looking on eBay and stuff like that, trying to think, oh, what did I used to buy? And suddenly you're like, oh my God, all these things like Dark Future, 150 quid, Mighty Empires, 200 quid, Blood Bowl.
And so where did your copies go to then?
Did you? Well, that was the thing. I sat there and I was like, oh my God, I've got like $4,000 worth of nonsense sat in my parents' loft. This is amazing. So the next time I was back, had dinner and stuff and it's all nice. And I was like, do you mind? I just need to go up into the loft and try and find something. They're like, well, fine. Went up there, you know, 4 inches of dust on everything going around. And I'm like, oh, this is odd. There's like teddy bears here. There's a load of Lego. There's all this stuff that hasn't been seen for whatever. And I came down and I was like, do you remember those little toys I used to be into? And they're like, oh, my mum was like, oh yeah. And I was like, yeah, do you know where they are? And she's like, oh, yeah. Like a week after I went to university, they all got dumped down the charity shop. Like literally, I'd been gone, I think, 1 week. And she's like, my mum's family, I'm very much a hoarder. My mum has lots of hoarders in her house, in her family, people who collect, you know, genuinely the kind of people that need interventions. And she's the opposite. She is like, doesn't like anything that's more than like 5 minutes old in the house. Repaints the place constantly. And yeah, I mean, I've been gone 5 minutes and she literally turfed everything out. I mean, we're talking about $3,000's worth, like today in today's money, about $3,000's worth of role-playing games, miniatures, all the literally like every big box Games Workshop did between about 87 and 91. Heartbreaking. Basically, so I've been slowly, as the magazine's gone on, every time we do an issue, I treat myself to one object from the past to kind of slowly fill up the collection again. But
the odd thing is, of course, that your stuff is probably still in circulation, being sold on eBay.
Oh, yeah. I keep thinking I'll buy it, you know, like it'll turn up and it'll be my little notes in the, like, sort of scribbled all over it or something. But, that was a hard wake-up call, kind of like, yeah. She showed absolutely no contrition. I was like, you do realize how much that is? She's like, how was I supposed to, you know, it's like, I mean, we were just talking before we went on, it's like records behind me. When I moved, I live in Belgium, and when I moved over here, I put half my records in storage and half came over here, actually a third in storage, a third here, and then a third went into her spare room. And 12 years later, they're still there. And she keeps sending me like, oh, I met some guy at the pub who apparently buys vinyl and he's going to come around and price it all up. And I'm like, oh my God, please don't. That's worth even more than the bloody miniatures. You know, it's like, there's some incredible stuff.
Obviously, you've come back into role playing. You start to rebuild your collection. And I'm going to put this to you in a fighting fantasy way. There's three routes you can take. There's one where you just play the games and enjoy yourself. There's a middle route, which is quite easy going, doing a podcast about it, for example. Come into it like some idiot and do a podcast about it, right? And then there's this really hard route, really difficult way, that is doing a magazine about it. So why did you choose the really hard way?
Well, mainly because, if it isn't obvious now, I'm not a natural on doing podcasts or anything like that. Because, I've only done like two in the whole history of the magazine, and it's stupid because I really need to like publicize it, obviously, but I'm generally like, oh my God, I hate doing this. I blabber too much, my brain goes far too fast and I say too much. So yeah, when I thought about it, I was like, no, there's no way I can do a podcast, much as appealing as it is. But also, I say, like, my background outside of gaming is in the media. So I've worked most of my life in the music industry. And I've worked as a journalist, writing for people like Time Out and DJ Mag and far too many websites to think about. But also, my main employment has been doing PR and marketing for record labels. So I've always worked around magazines and around the media. And I love magazines. Like, genuinely, as much as Weird Science is about games, for me, it's equally as much about magazines. Because, like I said, like, it was White Dwarf, but, like, growing up in the 80s in, like, West London, like, suburbs, you have a small world. It was a lovely, lovely world, but it's quite a small world. And for me, my exposure to the world and discovering all stuff was through magazines. I've got two older sisters, 10 years older than me. So I learned a lot by reading their magazines, and not just because, you know, delicately, you know, Cosmopolitan and Marie Claire had some interesting articles for a 12-year-old boy to be reading. So,
I read those agony letters as well. So you're all right. You're in safe hands. You know, you're in good company.
But for everything, it was like, you know, age 13, you know, reading my sister's copies of, like, ID in the Face. And that's how I discovered so much stuff that matters to me, you know, in terms of just in the world, but in terms of fashion, culture and music and film and all these things. And then as soon as I was kind of, you know, old enough to have a paper round and some money of my own, you know, you'd go down the shop and pick up, you know, your White Dwarf or whatever. But there was just, you know, I was, you know, religiously read, like, Enemy and Melodymaker and all these things, Select and magazines like that. And you just discovered so much more than was around you. So I've always loved magazines, and I've always loved the way that they do that, you know, with Enemy or something like that, is, you know, you'd have someone like Oasis on the front cover to sell the magazine. But once you've picked that up and read it, you read the rest of it. And that's how you discover stuff that you never, ever would have encountered otherwise. And I think that's why, it's what I love about magazines, is that you might pick up, you know, it's the way the world's set up at the moment, everything is so algorithmically driven that it's a very clever funnel system to give you more of what you know and more of what you like. So, you know, you spend 2 minutes looking at a Dungeons & Dragons thing on Instagram, then you're just going to get Dungeons & Dragons, Dungeons & Dragons, Dungeons & Dragons thrown at you constantly. You know, if you like one thing, it narrows your focus constantly. You know, we're more and more reduced to being, serendipity doesn't seem to happen as much. You don't find stuff by chance as much, which is crazy because, you know, the internet has made it so easy to discover stuff. And I think at first it did, but increasingly the way we internet has made it harder and harder to lock, it locks you in. And it's great at first, you know, it's like things like Spotify or something like that. When you first start using it, it's like, okay, great. It's really showing me lots of new music and stuff like that. But it very quickly goes, you like this, so we're going to give you lots more of exactly the same thing or something very, very close to it, which is on one level great. But it means you don't find the stuff that might change your life, you know. And when I think about the bands and stuff like that that absolutely, like, genuinely changed my life, it would be because I picked up a magazine because there was, I don't know, when I was 12, 13, 14 or something, Sisters of Mercy on the cover. Well, probably really weren't on the cover of The Enemy at that time, but, you know, there might have been something about a band, Fields of Nephilim, Sisters of Mercy, something like that, that I happened to be into at that point. And then because you've got the whole thing, you read it, you know, you read it cover to cover. And then because of that, you find, you know, for me, it was like discovering Aphex Twin or something like that, that completely then you're like, oh, wow, this is so out of my sphere of reference. And then you hunt down and find out more about that, and that changed your life. And that's what I hope with the magazine can do. We're saying Weird Science is that, I mean, what I haven't done with Weird Science is the obvious thing of putting Dungeons & Dragons on the cover every issue and then filling the rest of it with other weirder, cooler stuff from the indie world. That's what if I had a commercial brain, that's exactly what I would do. Instead, I hire people to do these covers that don't tell anybody anything about the magazine at all. But they are
wonderful, and it's a good point.
They
you
are
make.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a good point you make, really, because that is part of the enchitification of the internet, isn't it? That people have lost their curiosity about what might be found. I remember getting. Do you remember Rocking Vicar, the old email round robin that was sent with like curiosities that you'd find on the internet,
yeah.
Like pictures of birds with arms and things like that. That's all kind of disappeared, hasn't it, in this new homogenized, emulsified world?
Yeah, I think we just get the word I hate more than anything is content, but that's what we get. It's just, you know, it's, and I'm as, you know, I can get my high horse about this, and I do. Frequently, but I'm as bad as anyone else. You know, I can sit. Like the other day, I had a whole night free to myself, and I thought, okay, got a stack of books that I've been buying but not reading, as you do. And I thought I'd crack into one of them. But okay, I'm going to treat myself first to a little 2 minutes on Instagram just to, I can convince myself the new issue's come out. Let's see if anyone's talking about us. And then like 4 hours later, I've just watched, I've watched a million Sopranos 30-second clips, between like Sopranos and Curb Your Enthusiasm, I can just sit there and watch these bite-sized 15-second clips that they do. It feeds you and feeds you, and suddenly it's 1 a.m. and you're like, okay, that was mildly amusing and pleasurable, but I've just watched something that I'd watched 10, 15 years ago.
I think magazines do give you that opportunity of getting serendipity. Have you heard of Stack? Because I share your enthusiasm for independent magazines. It's not my games collection that causes friction in our household. It's the amount of subscriptions I have to magazines. And as well as subscribing to Weird Science, if you're into independent magazines, you should subscribe to Stack, because every month you get a independent magazine from anywhere in the world. And honestly, you learn such a lot about culture, about different lifestyles and people out there. So that's the thing that magazines can give you that other things can't, I think.
And I would 100% recommend. Yeah, Stack is great. Funnily enough, I'm talking to Stephen, who runs that, tomorrow. We're doing an interview about the magazine for them. But hopefully, maybe if you subscribe to Stack, you might get Weird Science one day. But yeah, no, totally. And it's like I buy so many magazines, and there's a few that I buy regularly. 14 times I've been a subscriber for I think 25 years or something like that, and I've got every single issue in over there. And it's I think if you're going to subscribe to one magazine, make it Weird Science. Two, make it 14 times as well, because that's just I don't know how you can create adventures or run games, you know, without that, because it's just an endless amount of inspiration. But yeah, I mean, I buy probably like 10 or 15 a month of different things, you know, and there's certain ones that I buy all the time, like Pressing Matters, Mundial. But I just go into a shop and I'll find something interesting. And like you say, you don't know what you're going to discover from it. That's what I always love about it. Even if it's like music, it's like you buy it to because you think you know what's going to be in there, and then hopefully there's always at least one thing that you've never heard of, you've never even had an idea that it could exist. And and I say it, like the way magazines tend to work is you can actually, like, I worked on websites for a very, very long time, culture kind of music websites and stuff like that, and we saw it from the mid early 2000s to the 2010 early 2010s change so dramatically. The way originally people would come onto your website and they would go from page to page and have a look at what you'd posted, and it changed to people just sat on social media and they'd wait for the band that they liked to say something. Yeah, oh, we've been interviewed by Clash or something like that. And then you get all your traffic would come through a direct recommendation. But then people would never look, people wouldn't think, oh, I'm on this website now, I'm going to have a look at what else is on there. But as I say, like, that's the thing, like, film magazines like Little White Lies I get, And it's great because I can't, there's no way you can keep up with everything, but it's like a very curated experience of someone going, you know, a lot of smart, generally people who know a subject very well going, well, this is what is interesting us this month. And I think that's a lovely thing to be able to just have and spend an hour or two reading. And say when it's when you find stuff that you had no prior interest in, and it maybe it sparks a completely new hobby or a new interest, or maybe it's just a brief, you know, there's a magazine called Monocle that I get all the time, and it's the most ridiculous magazine. It's the kind of magazine that is, you assume it's read by Zurich bankers because everything is absolutely beautiful. Design is gorgeous. They recommend like £500 cashmere jumpers and stuff like that. It's like, oh, if you need like a basic entry level sweater, here's our £700 one. It's that kind of magazine. But, you know, it has interviews with, it'll have an interview of like the, I don't know, the person who's in charge of traffic control in Kuala Lumpur or something like that. And it'll be like 6-page interview with them. And once you kind of reconfigure your brain to be like, okay, this is, there'll be something of interest here. It's fascinating. You just get this complete like view on the world. And I kind of, that's what I want with Weird Science. That's why it's, people who've read it the last few issues will have noticed we've kind of expanded the non-gaming content in there. Because just as when I always thought it was like, oh, I don't want it just to be role-playing games because I think there's all these blurry edges. So, you know, I'm interested in war games. I'm interested in board games. And I think I'm more interested in how any of these games make us, what they tell us about the world around us or how they influence world or how the world influences them. From that, I was like, well, you know, if you're reading this, you're probably interested in science fiction and fantasy, your science, these kind of things. I thought, okay, we can have a space for that. And then the other thing is, there's always that thing where you pick up a magazine like Starburst or something like that, and it'll be a music magazine or a film magazine, and they'll have one page on games or something like that, and you know, they'll throw you a bone, and they'll be, so I kind of wanted to be the reverse of that, where it's like, you know, we can patronize that, oh, you've released a film, have you, that's interesting, we might be able to find a page for you or something like that, you know, to talk about it. But I wanted to kind of make it more of a cultural thing. The whole way I look at games and magazine, or want to look at games and magazines, as I say, it's like looking at them as what do games tell us about us, you know, whether it's social history or the time. And, you know, I think you can learn, just as no one would ever question you if you said, what do TV shows in the 1980s, you know, what does Boys from the Black Stuff, or what does A Feed the Same Pet or something like that? Yes, they're entertainment and, you know, they were watched by millions, but you can use them, they're part of social history. You can look at it and say, okay, what does, you know, if someone's looking back at the history of the 1980s in the UK, you can use films, you can use music as a way to talk about that. And I think it's exactly the same thing. You can talk about, what does Warhammer tell you about 1980s Britain? Quite a lot, I think, whether it was intended by, you know, you can overreach. And I think there's a lot of people, so like me, who have, you know, share my kind of vaguely more, let's say, socialist beliefs or something like that, that want Warhammer to be this perfect satire of Thatcher's Britain. And I think that's a bit of a stretch, you know, having talked to like Rick Priestley and stuff like that, you know, they probably wouldn't come out and out say that. But at the same time, it was just what they were swimming in. You know, if you were vaguely countercultural in the 1980s and you were living in the Midlands in a vaguely depressed town, you know, there's absolutely no way that you aren't affected by the politics of what's around you. And even if you don't go out of your way to make Warhammer this perfect satire, and it's not, you know, it fails on several levels, but it on, you know, you're still being influenced by that. And the stuff that they're cribbing from, so 2000 AD, stuff like that, that's, again, it's people being written by people who are trying to say something about the world around them in a comic form, but also being entertaining at the same point. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's, you know, there's all these influences around. So I think you can look back at it. And Malcolm Craig did a really, really good feature in our last issue on Cold War RPGs. So it's what he's doing a big thing on at his university. And
yeah. I think as well, I just want to point out your latest issue, issue 8, reminds us, doesn't it, that you've got a really good article in there from Shannon Appleklein about how role-playing games themselves are rooted in magazines. That's where they started. Sort of chainmail was first printed through zines. And you've got a really good piece on Lee Gold, who, of course, had the Alarums and Excursions, which finished recently after nearly 50 years. So role-playing games are also rooted in these periodicals, aren't they?
Yeah, 100%. And it's a very odd history, because it would be like if there was like two main music magazines for the last 50 years and they'd all been published by like Sony and Universal Records. And I think there is this weird thing with print media and magazines and role-playing games. And like you said, like the early history of it was all those APAs and all those zines being made, and incredible. I mean, I've got this, someone a year ago sent me this stack, like massive 10-kilogram box of 80s British RPG zines, and they're beautiful to read through, and only 200 people might have read it. So it's like you're constantly reinventing the wheel, unfortunately, which has been a problem that we've role-playing games have had. But yeah, totally. I mean, so much of the early discussion and the people hitting ideas back and forth, and the just finding out what, you know, when they were trying to figure out what is this, you know, what are we actually playing? Because I think that's a huge question for a lot of them at the time, was, you know, what the hell are, you know, this is something that is a bit similar to games that have existed before, but not exactly, you know, it was its own thing. And so, yeah, hundreds of these zines and people just spilling their creativity out into it. And then, of course, you have White Dwarf and Imagine. But as I said, it's very odd that, you know, the two, you know, when we think of role-playing game magazines, you'll probably think of early White Dwarf, you'll think of Dragon, you know, Imagine if you're in the UK. But of course, you know, these were in-house magazines. And there have been very good non-in-house ones, Arcane, Adventurer, and a few like that, but they tend to last about, you know, 10 issues or something like that. And it was, there still is people, when I said I was going to do a magazine about role-playing games, I think the assumption for a lot of people I first spoke to would be, oh, it'd be like adventures and new rules and stuff like that. And I did think about that, and I was like, does that make sense? I mean, part of it is, you know, the tradition of role-playing game magazines is that they are just full of new rules and new adventures and new classes and all these things. I was like, well, the thing is, we're overloaded with that stuff now. There is, you know, when I was, you know, when we were kids, getting it via, you know, getting new adventures via White Dwarf was one of the only ways you could get semi-official. You know, obviously we were all creating our own adventures, but that was you'd have the adventures in White Dwarf or something like that as a kind of yardstick to hold your own homebrew stuff up against and see what it is. And that was the only way we were getting new official content. Whereas today, obviously, it's, I don't know, you know, I imagine most of us have got far too much. You know, we're drowning in new rules and new adventures. And at the drop of a hat, I mean, I've got a little hard drive down here with like a terabyte of PDFs of probably just all from about two bundles, you know, one of these big itch bundles for charity or something. And I've got like 10,000 PDFs now of every single game and thing you could possibly hope for. And if I want a new adventure, I can go on to DriveThruRPG and I can download one in seconds. So that was the thing when I started the magazine. I was like, okay, what actually are we going to cover? how are we going to do it? And I was like, well, I want it to be more like something like Little White Lies or, you know, The Wire, or like a music magazine where we treat games as cultural objects and worthy of discussing them as things that matter, not just as toys or whatever.
And, I think you do that really effectively. I think particularly in this issue that there's a kind of dialogue taking place between the different articles as well. So there's kind of a consistency to it. So well done for that. And the other thing I wanted to point out, you know, you started this by saying you weren't a graphic designer, but the pages that you've done about fanzines are amazing.
I'm kind of torn about that feature because Shannon sent it over and it was really nice. I kind of started laying it out and it was a real pain in the ass to lay out. I couldn't work out how to lay it out. And then I was like, it struck me, okay, what I'll do is, because originally I'd done the fake zine for the Lee Gold interview. And I did that and I bought some Letra set and I had a really, really, really fun time. And I was like, this is so much fun. And I made the, you know, sat there scribbling away, making it. I thought, okay, that's nice. I'll do a similar one for the Shannon article, but just as the cover. And then I tried to lay it out and I couldn't. It took me, it just didn't look good at all. And then I struck me, okay, well, let's make a full zine and then we'll photocopy it and do all that. And I think it works. And I was terrified about it because I thought there's a very, very, very good chance that it won't have come out when it's printed. It will be too dark or it will be too, I'll have messed something up and it'll be fuzzy or something. But actually, thankfully, it's come out quite nicely. But I did really enjoy doing that. But it didn't come out quite how I wanted because it was like, we went to print on like the Monday evening and this was like Saturday afternoon. I got back from trip. I looked at the magazine again just before and I thought, no, that's not good enough. I need to fix this. So it was like in the space of like one afternoon, cutting, photocopying stuff, cutting it up. And if I'd had like a couple of days more, I could have made it nicer, I think. But it was really fun. And I say, like, I love doing that. And from doing that, we have had this idea of, I've been trying to think of a way of making, of giving something back to subscribers because that's how the magazine lives, you know. And at the moment, if you subscribe, it's like a pound cheaper or something, which is, you know, nice. But these days, that's what, like half a biscuit or something. So what I'm trying to do is I was going to do, hopefully in the next issue, maybe the issue after, we're going to start doing a little zine, to like a proper A5 zine to go with the magazine for subscribers of something either just related to the issue as a whole, but like something separate in some way. Just because I had so much fun sitting there with, you know, the X-Acto knife, cutting things up and chopping it out and trying to add in Tippex and stuff to make it look. Yeah. You know, there were bits that actually were genuinely, like I managed to cut myself doing it and did like shoot blood out. So there's one bit where there's a load of Tippex on it, which is covering up, you know, quite gory blood spurt. But then there's other bits where, you know, you're trying to make it look as old and thing as possible. So it's a bit of a conceit, but yeah.
I liked it a lot. I liked it a lot in it, and it's very readable as well. So well done with that. I mean, it goes back to your origins, isn't it? That DIY culture, which is drew you to role playing in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, like when we grew up, you just had to make do with, you know, I didn't grow up on the poverty line or anything like that. I grew up, you know, nice kind of working class, lower middle class family kind of thing. But, you know, you just didn't have much, you know, you invented, you know, you took what you had and built on that. And that's kind of, you know, it's the perfect hobby for that, I think.
Tell us how we can get hold of Weird Science.
Yes. So the easiest way is just to go to, well, our website, which is weird.science. And then if you click on shop. So if you go there, you can find all the back issues we've got in print or a link to subscribe on the new issue. And yeah, we got a... we can ship worldwide, So it's, if anyone's interested and wants to check it out, then head over there. Thank you so much for having me. And sorry, I probably waffled on in an incredibly random manner. But it's been lovely to Grognard. When I got back into games, the Grognard Files was a huge thing that convinced me that it was that you could, as you say, look back as well as look forward. And you didn't just have to be focused on the glorious past. You know, there was a glorious future as well. So coming on here, it's like getting my Blue Peter badge, I feel like. Oh. It's been a pleasure. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you.
Open box. Welcome to the room of role-playing mumbling. And I am in a room. I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Doug.
Now, this is a part of the show where we look backwards to look forward.
So far, yeah.
Now, I know that you've got some trepidation about this because you don't know what's coming, do you?
No, I never do. Let's hope it works.
So what I'm going to do, because we haven't done this for a while, is I'm going to take us in a time machine back to 1983. Mm. We're in my bedroom. I don't know if you remember this era of my bedroom. This is,
I do remember, yeah. I've not got, there's nothing wrong with me. I can remember things, yeah.
But if you look around the room,
yeah.
What are you seeing around the room?
Which bedroom is this? Parkville Road?
I have moved into the new
moved
house.
Moved into the new house.
Yeah, and my dad has been quite extravagant with
I'm seeing like 1980s red and white furniture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that kind of bright colour contrast furniture.
White shelves, red tubing.
Yeah. And we painted your bedroom. I remember painting your bedroom. What colour did we paint it?
It was red.
Was it red? We painted the walls red, didn't we?
It was.
Yeah. That High Plains Drifter. Painted the walls red. I remember that, yeah. So, yeah, I can remember.
No, my dad went hog wild at MFA. He treated me. I got a desk, and the desk was too big for the room. It looked smaller in the shop.
Yeah.
And I built it myself, so don't open those drawers.
Yeah, don't you know the front will fall off.
And I remember this because this is the thing that on the top of there, I didn't have a reading lamp. So what I thought I'd do, I wouldn't ask for a reading lamp because they bought all this stuff. I'd use my bike lamp as a room.
Yeah.
But it leaked the
battery acid, yeah.
And it was from the day one that a battery acid had left a stain there. And so whenever my mum and dad came in, I had to manoeuvre things to cover it.
Do you remember that? Yeah.
And on that desk, of course, is a Silver Reed 17 typewriter, because we're going to need that.
Going to need a typewriter.
Yeah. And in the corner there is my dad, mum and dad's old Valve set colour TV, first one they got in the 70s.
Yeah.
Ignore the smell of burning.
Yeah.
That'll go eventually.
Yeah, it'll go. We'll open a window.
Yeah, as the dog. Open a window.
Open the door. Another window, yeah. Was it the dog? Anyway, everyone blamed the dog, but was it the dog?
So we're in that room, and I want to take you back to 1983, because that was the point that we thought we would do a fanzine.
Oh, yeah.
A fanzine together.
Yeah.
So this is an imaginative exercise. Over the course of the next 40-odd minutes, we're going to produce a fanzine. Mm. But the good thing about this is that it's a fanzine of the imagination that we don't have to do.
Oh, thank God for that. That's a good thing. Because in those days, there was no such thing as podcasts. And also, the idea of a fanzine involved actual effort, didn't it? Whereas this rubbish, it's just thrown together. Us talking, in case anyone hasn't noticed. You don't have to actually do it. Well, that was all right.
Yeah. So what it'll do, we're giving a gift to people listening. It exists in their imaginations. Hmm. We don't have to print it.
It'll be very much better there as well.
Yeah.
It'll look better in their imagination.
Yeah.
Well, I hope it will.
It is odd. I've been listening to ACFM, which is the podcast done by Jem and Kia and Nadia, and they were talking about hobbies.
Yeah.
And about the political significance of hobbies. But they make a point in there about how projects bring men together.
Yes. Yes.
It is odd that our friendship, we've known each other for a very long time.
Yeah.
See, 47 years.
Yeah.
And what's bound us together is having like odd projects.
Well, I remember a while ago talking to someone who was a social worker, a children's social worker, and they made a very interesting point. It was about like young people's mental health, how it's they said that what boys do is they get involved in hobbies and interests. So often young men's mental health has kind of suffered, of course, but they said that they cope with things by going playing football, taking apart a car, customizing the bicycle.
Yeah.
Those kind of things are the very male orientated hobbies and interests. So they might not be very social with each other in the way that girls are, but that sociability comes through, let's all customize our bicycle. Let's all do this. And I suppose that's what we were like at role playing. Creating a fanzine was like these projects. And
building a robot was
one. Yeah, building a robot. And how are we supposed to do that? Yeah.
Real grand designs that it was going to be.
It sounds stupid, but then a few years later, Robot Wars came along. People clearly doing that, weren't they?
Exactly.
The only difference is we couldn't deny to do it. That's the difference. No technical knowledge whatsoever.
We did follow the same logic in sticking a biscuit tin on a big truck or something, wasn't
it? Yeah, we did do that.
Yeah.
But it didn't have like a hammer on top going up and down to smash someone else's robot to pieces. But it was
now I feel like I've missed out.
Yeah. Not really a robot. I mean, Tip says robot wise, it's a remote control car with a hammer on it, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's not like a robot. It's not like C-3PO, is it?
No.
I mean, I used to quite like Robot Wars, but I always remember thinking, is this a robot or is it, like you say, just a big truck with the biscuits in on? It's not a robot, then, is it, really? Not what I would, in the popular imagination, a robot.
No.
A robot would be something that, I don't know, brought you a drink or something, or engaged in conversation, or tried to take over your house and kill you. That's a robot, isn't it?
Yeah. There are times watching it when you get that kind of frustrating feeling that this is very low grade entertainment.
It is.
When Sir Killalot's trying to push a biscuit tin into a hole, you're thinking, what am I doing with that?
Sure. A biscuit tin painted silver into a hole.
Yeah.
And at the same time, avoiding the exciting flames that might be shooting out of one other part of the stage, so no one ever goes near.
Yeah.
Won't replace entertainment.
Yeah. No. But creating fanzine has always been entertaining. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a fanzine.
Okay.
So we'll talk about aesthetics. It's going to have a pink cover, isn't it? Because the local VG shop where we do the copying.
Yeah, we wouldn't want white paper because that would seem boring, but the only coloured paper she got is pink.
Yes.
That's what you stuck with. Yeah.
So it's on pink paper. And we need to come up with a name. Now, to save us a bit of time, I have created a fanzine, a title, Arama.
And there you have. You tested this by text on me last night, didn't you?
Yeah, and you got a bit confused.
I thought you'd gone mad. You're just sending me random. Luke's gone mad. The podcast's going to have to end. He's just sending random words to me. What's gone wrong with it?
So what I've got two lots of 20 nouns.
Okay.
With 20 verbs in the middle. All right?
Okay.
Are you with me so far?
I'm with you so far.
I've got them on the table.
Yeah.
And we're going to roll these, not apparently at random, but actually at random. So you're going to do yes.
Okay. Is this instead of just making a name up?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. But they always had like convoluted names.
They did have to have stupid names
Yeah. I think the one we went for was the Armchair Adventurers Gazette.
Yeah.
But it was boring compared
to... Boring is like pompous. Yeah. But you had like Tempestuous Orifice and things like that.
Didn't you?
There was one called that.
I
don't know why it sticks in my mind, but it does.
Tempestuous Orifice.
Was it Tempestuous or Torching? I can't remember now.
There was one called Verbal Diarrhea that I used to sign up for. And the other one, I guess, is Doom's Book of Chaos. And that was actually done in Bolton. I only found out recently that it was done in Bolton. So let's see what we can come up
with.
All
right, let's roll.
Okay.
Here we go.
So the first one is
11.
11. So 11 is Quartz Monster. Quartz Warts Monster.
Okay, and roll again?
Yes.
12.
12. Quartz Monster Freezes.
8.
8. Zodani.
Quartz Monster Freezes Zodani.
And we're going for that one. Or do you want? You can keep that. You can take that away with you tonight.
Tonight, but
if I go again,
do I lose that one? Or can I?
You can have that. You've still got Quartz Monster.
Should we try another one?
Yeah, go on.
All right. Okay. I'm not sure it works. 12.
You're 12 again.
No. The other.
Yeah. So, Torquemada,
yeah.
Nine. Meets.
Oh, this is more promising. 18.
Doom.
Torquemada meets Doom. I prefer that.
It works, that one, doesn't it?
That's, yeah.
Torquemada meets Doom. Let's have the third one, because right. The best out of three.
Best out, so far, I prefer that.
I did spend an hour doing this, so I want to
get the knowledge with 10.
10. Zed's crutch spike.
I already don't like it.
Zed's
no point crutch. Going any further.
Zed?
What?
Zed's crutch spike. I think it's like a...
Zed's crutch spike.
What? Greg's crutch spike.
Greg's? Is that like the sausage rolls? They do.
Zed's?
I forgot. Zed's or Greg's? Zed's
said Greg's then.
You're sitting just on the pasties of the mat and your brain.
You said Greg's,
I'm sure. Don't edit that out. You said Greg's. Go on.
Right. Zed's. Crotch spike.
Okay.
I think it's a reference to David Bowie in The Labyrinth.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And the next bit
is Zed's crotch spike.
Seven.
Winds up.
Seven again.
Top deck. Zed's that doesn't work, does it?
Torquemada meets Doom.
Torquemada meets Doom. Okay, there you go. That's
did you just shot it? Torquemada's Doom.
Torquemada's Doom. Yeah,
that work.
I
think that feels in keeping with the kind of names they had at the time.
Yeah. Torquemada's Doom.
Torquemada's Doom. That's
our new fanzine. Yeah, can see it in your
on issue only, being delivered straight to your imagination. This is the best place for it.
So, when you think of fanzine, when you get a magazine, we used to get the White Dwarf. Where was it that you first went to?
Well, they were always full of things you would never use, aren't they?
Yeah.
They were full of, you know, so you'd get like a character class for D&D that someone had made up. Armourer, Gladiators, but there were always that character classes where you think, well, what use is this in the game? I mean, it's so niche. They were almost like character classes that White Dwarf had projected. Yeah. You always get that feeling, like, have you sent this to White Dwarf and they've rejected it? And then you sometimes got a scenario. And in a way, I always kind of ignored those things because, I always went for the articles. I think you were always going for, I was always looking for an article about how to do stuff. Even though these things were written, you know, they weren't written by experts, were they? I mean, they were just written, and there were no experts then, were there? But looking for advice, because at that point in our life, you didn't know many people who played. So you were keen. I was always kind of interested in what other people did or how they did it or what their opinion was on it. And a fanzine was a way of getting that at the time, because of course, back then, that was all you had, wasn't it?
Yeah,
so I would always kind of look for articles that were more general about stuff rather than very specific things for a particular game.
Yeah, I really bought into the in jokes that were in there, that kind of an editorial involvement.
Yeah,
where the editor was like talking to you about how it had been delayed and those problems.
Yeah, because it was like contacting the real world.
Yeah. Almost. And they'd mention like, because I don't know, Zed or Greg has not been running his D&D campaign. And it was just those little bits. You'd only get like looking at bits of them.
They were like glimpses that other people were doing what you were doing.
Yeah. Similarly in the letters pages, you got that sense that people were submitting stuff and asking questions that you were mentally asking as well.
Yeah. It was like the communicative element of it that you were hearing things. It was like a weird thing, like it was like a phone tap or something, wasn't it? Where you were listening in to the world out there where other people were playing games. But when really it was just three or four of us that played it, and didn't really have a sense of anyone else playing it.
Yeah, and you get like the turns being played out of PBMs as well, didn't they?
So, yeah.
And just like listening, some of it, like the diplomacy ones, I just didn't understand like a series of numbers. So you're trying to decipher it and decipher as well. Although it's like trying to read between the lines of what was going on.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to.
It was a bit like a seance.
Yeah,
you were contacting the spirit world. There was definitely a spirit world out there. It didn't always quite make sense, but it was reassuring that it existed and it was out there. You were on your own. That's what it felt like.
Isn't it odd, though, that what they were trying to give you was like gameable content, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So they were trying to give you the fanzine. In the fanzine, they were trying to give you scenarios, new spells, new character classes.
Yeah, what they were trying to give you was, I've created this character class. I've created this, I don't know, pirate character class, for example.
Yeah. Something like that.
That they would think, this is great, because I'm putting it out there. I've written this scenario, and I put it out there, and people will play this. And I, like you said, I'm giving you some kind of content, something to use in your game. But that's not quite what you were looking for, is it? You wouldn't necessarily use those things at all, would you?
Yeah. What striking now, if you come into the 21st century, that magazines that are out there, so like Weird Science and Nevermind the Dice Rolls and others that are produced, they don't have any of that gameable content in. It is all about the chat and the articles and about the conversation and the cultural significance of particular games or where they fit in.
Mm.
Arguably now, I want more gameable content. Is that odd?
Well, yeah, I suppose it's not, because I think as you, the more you play the game and the older you get, I suppose you get more confident about the way you do it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, don't know about you, but I kind of think this is the way I run a game, this is the way I play a game, and that's that. Not that you can't learn new things and learn new approaches, but you have more of a sense of yourself, whereas back then I don't think we did we?
No.
There was always that sense of, am I doing it right? Whereas now I think, well, I don't care whether I'm doing it right, I'm doing it the way I'm doing it. And it seems to work for the people I play with, and that's good enough, really.
And what I could really do with now is somebody coming up with a really good monster because I'm stuck.
Yeah, or a great little one-shot scenario for a convention I'm doing in a month's two's time. Yeah,
yeah.
It would be really good. Yeah, so I suppose you're looking for stuff. Because I suppose, again, come back to that thing of now, time is more precious, isn't it? Because you're working, got families. Whereas then, you had all the time in the world to come up with a scenario.
Exactly.
That wasn't the problem. The problem was, is the scenario I've come up with a good way of doing this? So that's what you were looking for. Whereas now, if someone said, right, are you running a game next week? Come up with a scenario for next week. You think, okay, hang on. Have I got time to do this? What am I doing at the weekend? That kind of thing. Whereas back then, if someone said, come up with a scenario for next week, you'd pull the time of the world, didn't you?
Yeah. But also, you just were more able to make stuff up as well, and felt more confident about just making stuff up, because it didn't matter, did it?
It didn't matter as much. And I suppose because something you'd never done before seemed exciting because you'd just never done it before. So things that might seem a bit hackneyed now didn't then, because you'd never done that before.
Yeah.
Really.
And also, there wasn't the same commitment to having something that was narratively cohesive. It was more about the next encounter.
It was just fun to be in that world.
Yeah.
Knocking around, fighting monsters and doing things. Yeah.
So we're going to have a feature article each.
Okay.
All right. What's your feature article? Or do you want me to go first with mine?
You go first.
All right. So my first one is, it's something I was trying to pick up with you last time, but you kind of batted away when we were talking about Pirates of Drennet, which is fair enough because we have a lot to cover. But what is it about particular campaigns that makes you gravitate towards them? Now, in 1983, this would be even more pertinent, because what we'd be doing is looking at open box, and you'd see these campaigns and games being presented to you, and you had no sense really of what they were.
Yeah, yeah.
And very often what you were doing was making stuff up, like we're saying. You never, we could, Did we even call them campaigns? I'm not sure as we did.
No, I don't think we did, no. Not initially. I think we did later on when the term became like bandied around.
Yeah, I think it was the stuff you bought.
In fact, I remember that. Now, that's your false memory, this. I don't know. Maybe you roomed about one time. Yeah. I don't know. But I think I remember a conversation with you actually once, and you telling me that something along the lines of, well, what you do is you run lots of games that are all interlinked, and they call it a campaign.
Yes.
I think I remember that conversation.
And I probably got that from a fanzine.
Yeah, they call it. I think you remember you saying that it's called a campaign. You know, right, okay, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Then I think we just said, oh, we're running a campaign then. Let's all run campaigns. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah. And obviously, we've talked extensively about the ones that we went towards and loved, so Borderlands.
Yeah.
And it had that gravitas, didn't it? But I do think that thing, what is it? And then and now that makes you think, right, I'm gonna run this, I'm gonna commit to it, get the book. It's a big book, I'm gonna commit to it.
Yeah.
And find the time, carve out the time to do it.
Yeah.
And at what point do you determine that actually this has got to end?
Yeah. It is a strange thing, that. Why are you drawn to certain things? Some things you're just drawn to, and other things you're not, are you? You bounce off them a bit and think, oh, no, I'm not interested in that. Yeah, it's strange. I think recently, like for my birthday, which was last week, I got the Mythic Carpathia book for Basin. And I've always fancied it, set in like Eastern Europe, Hungary and Prague and all that. It was vampires in it, and a bit more kind of Eastern European. I always fancied, why? I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It just has a certain sort of romantic air to it that I think, oh, that's good, you know, that kind of, you know, Transylvania, that kind of thing. You know, I think, well, I don't know why, but somehow it pushes my buttons. Whereas other things don't. It is an odd thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't know that much about it. And sometimes reading reviews of campaigns, if you're trying to make your mind up, in some ways they're not much use, because you get people who say, oh, it's not good, and some people say, oh, it's really good, and you think, oh no, that's not much help.
I think it just comes from an instinct.
Yes.
Or just something that you're hooked into.
That's what I mean, yeah. It does. It's an instinct, or just something that somehow captures your imagination, and you're not quite sure why that would be.
There'll be a collective groan now. Remember, this is 1983.
Yeah.
And I'm going to mention RuneQuest because that was like pivotal to what we were doing at the time. But I think this follows through to now, like in the 21st century, is what type of campaign are you drawn towards?
Yeah.
So is it the episodic series of scenarios that I delivered and the collect packets together that you need to deliver? So we're at the moment running the Borealis connection, and that is a string of scenarios, a chain of scenarios, in the same way that Borderlands was. Right? On the other hand, you can get the ones that we refer to them now as sandboxes, but I'm not sure as they were.
No, I don't think they were sand.
And they're like settings books, aren't they? Like Harn was or Griffin Menti.
Yeah, I think the sandbox thing is kind of odd because, as you know, one of my little hobbies is to look, I like quite like looking at old D&D modules.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, at the time, they were all shrink-wrapped in Games Workshop, weren't they? So all you saw is the covers and the name, and I thought, well, that'll be exciting. And, of course, you couldn't buy them because of the Prime Directive. So, but I think what's interesting is that those settings like Harn, they weren't really a sandbox. They were just a setting, weren't they? That's all they were.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at some of there's a few early D&D modules from about that period where they are the beginnings of sandboxes. So there's one called the Curse of Bone Hill, that one they've talked about before. It got slagged off at the time, I think, quite badly by some critics. But now it's held in a bit more high regard because it is like a sandbox. It's like there's something going on in this area, but you're just dropped in it and can work out what's going on and interact with various factions as you see fit. So it's at the beginnings of a sandbox.
Yeah.
But it wasn't called a sandbox. And I think they were quite rare back then because, as you say, settings like Harn were, because that Thieves World, isn't it? I mean, you could say it's a sandbox because you go into Thieves World and you do stuff.
The places are open.
But it's not really a sandbox. I wouldn't say it's a sandbox campaign because there's no necessary overarching plot, is there? If you see what I mean.
Yeah. But what I want to say in this article, for our readers,
yes,
is that I'm dissatisfied with both, because if I look at the at my past record, I tend to go for the episodic ones, only because that kind of allows me to compartmentalize it.
Yeah, and more manageable.
Yes. It means that I can cut and paste stuff and do it. And I think I like the idea of having, you know, climaxes along the way, so that it's kind of building up, and that arcing idea that between each of these different scenarios, ultimately it's going to reach a point where everything comes together, like your massive Neathletep and all that kind of approach. But I'm always getting them, and I'm a bit dissatisfied and plodding through them. What I really like as a player is the sandbox, this idea that you can feel your way around an area or an idea or a setting. But as a games master, I never go for those because I look at them and just think,
well, they're harder to work out.
They're harder work now, and I think they were harder work then.
Yeah, hard work to roll, because if you let players go anywhere, it's difficult to, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose as well, what's interesting, the idea of sandbox. See, we talked last time about Pirates Trinax. Actually, Phoenix was a sandbox. But what was interesting about that was the length of time we would play it on a Saturday morning meant that you couldn't get that far into it, and it allowed me to then prepare for the next one.
Yeah.
If you think back to the 80s,
yes,
we'd play for 8, 9, 10 hours. Yeah. So if you had a sandbox and players went a bit off-piste, it was a real problem, because we were playing this for another 6 hours. And what are you going over there for?
Yeah.
I've got to, you know, whereas in Pirates of Drinax, you would do something unpredictable. You would say, right, we're going to do some piracy here, then we're going to go over there. And I'd go, okay, right, do the piracy. That takes a bit of time. Travel over there. Give you a bit of an outline of the planet.
Yeah.
Oh, it's 12 o'clock. You land on the planet. Okay, great. I've got time to prepare for it. But back then, you would have landed on the planet and they're going to have another 6 hours.
Yeah.
I've not really got anything ready. I didn't think you were going to do that. So I think back then, the episodic things were far more appealing because there was that sense of you knew what you were dealing with.
Yeah.
You know?
I think my experience has been burned from the Conan.
Yeah, that was you're still smarting a bit from that, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. Sets Conan and the Sorcerer.
It was terrible, though.
It was terrible.
It's not your fault. I think there's a couple of things in it that when you told me about them, I thought, stupid.
But I was drawn to it because it seemed like the premise was good. It was like an interesting idea.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's only when you get into the weeds of it, you realise that, oh, God, this is...
It's not been put together properly. So there's a few plot holes and bits that you think, oh, no, that doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, yeah. And I think since then I've been quite cautious.
Mm.
And similar with the Borealis connection, which I'm loving, but it's just hard to keep that momentum. And I think I feel that I was enjoying it more when it was the sandboxy thing in Saigon.
Yeah.
Because you had like the location was in one place. And I think in some ways having a campaign that is just moving around a place is more, it's more interesting to develop, I think. So I am seeking a campaign that actually pushes me. So rather than having a string of scenarios, I want one that is more of a setting.
That would be your feature article.
That is my feature article.
Okay. Right.
Signed off, Dirt the Dice. Thank you. And I'll probably put questions at the end to invite a response from the article.
Like just letters page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's your feature?
I think my feature article, and this, I think this is still a bit of an issue today, but certainly was an issue then, would be handling of NPCs in games. Yes, I think back in the day, when you start out role-playing, it's all about fighting. So the most, particularly then, those games back then, RuneQuest, Traveller, D&D, it's all about, oh, monsters, treasure, get your character better with his sword, fight bigger monsters, that kind of thing. That's an easy way into it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where that's an obvious and easy thing that you do. What do you do with this game? Because I remember our first games, I think the first games were RuneQuest players, were really just set-piece fights, weren't they?
Set-piece fights. I remember Grindel, we mentioned before, became like an arch-enemy, didn't
he? Yeah,
For some reason. I think mainly because I used the Medusa figure.
The Medusa figure for him, didn't you? It's like an old woman Medusa. If you painted the hair grey, it just looked like grey hair rather than snakes. So
yeah,
it's like an old woman with crazy hair.
So get it into my head that it was ultimately
evil behind it all. Yeah.
And so all that meant was like for months, really, things were thrown at you. I bet it's Grindel who's done this.
Yeah. But I do think one of the hardest things when you start role-playing is the handling of NPCs. And it certainly was back then, I think, because it's a slightly trickier leap of the imagination, isn't it? So when you're like 14 years old, it's quite easy to think of fighting a manticore like some scene from Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. It's very easy to do that, isn't it? Because you've been brought up on those kind of films. Well, what's more difficult, sitting at that age, is to understand how the local captain of the city guard might feel about you lot carrying your sword around. See what I mean? It's a more difficult thing, isn't it? A difficult thing to get your head around. Maybe it's generally, but it's more difficult when you're that age. And certainly when I started playing, I remember thinking, remember like in Traveller, there was all the stuff with Simon where it all went, like all Traveller games then, everyone just becomes a space pirate, everyone just starts shooting people. Yeah. And it was fine, the fights were fine, but dealing with the kind of law enforcement elements of it, thinking, well, if they're doing this, what are the local law enforcement thinking? What are they going to do? What about that guy who survived and escaped and he knows who you are? What's he going to do now? You know, like thinking through these imaginary people's reactions and actions to things you're doing. Yeah. It's all right if you shoot, like Traveller, you shoot at someone with your laser rifle and they shoot back. That's easy to run, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if you shoot at him and he runs away, gets in the escape pod and thinks, well, they just tried to kill me. What's he going to do?
Yeah.
Where's he going to go? What are the consequences? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Those kind of things, I think, are quite tricky. And they were certainly tricky back then because it was almost like an unexpected consequence of a role-playing game. So you get into role-playing, you say, all right, you can be in a spaceship and fly around and do some piracy, do this and do that. Oh, that's all great. That all makes sense to you when you're 14. But what's trickier is almost like role-playing adults.
Yes.
Do you see what I mean? So you're actually required as a kid to sort of role-play an adult NPC, the local law enforcement on the planet you've landed on. And how are they going to react to you? What are they going to say? What are they going to do? You know, what's the view of you? If you try and bribe them, what's their reaction? I think they're really tricky things.
Yeah. And what I think underlying that was our obsession with creating NPCs as well. And we used to have these things called scenario nights.
We did.
On the Monday night where we got together. And it was about the painfulness of having to create NPCs.
Yeah.
But we were obsessed with creating stat blocks for those NPCs rather than creating personalities with an attitude.
Yeah.
And I think it came later, and I mentioned this before, that when you saw it in Imagine magazine, Imagine magazine, when they presented Pelennor, and they used to give a little bit of a flavor text about what that person was like, what motivates them, who they didn't like.
Yes. Yeah. And just a few bullet points, really, give you enough to think, oh, right, okay, get this point, which never really occurred to us. You're right. Because one of your big gripes about RuneQuest, you used to say, creating NPCs is so difficult. Yeah. You've got to go all the stats, work out their armor on each body part, and then work out the skills. It was really tedious, time consuming.
But one of the genius bits of Appleade, it wasn't really the stats blocks. Could have used anything. We used our brains and just thought, well, we could use anything for the block.
That
doesn't matter. It was that little block of text that explained who the person was.
Yes.
Yeah. And we never really got past that because, as you say, we were just obsessed with working.
Yeah, you're just a kid and you haven't really thought about what these people might really think or do and how they might respond to things in a, obviously not the real world, but in a kind of assumed real world, what would they really think? So I think that would be my feature article. It would be about tips on how to make your NPCs more. I'm sure I'd write it though. I've picked a feature article, but what I'm saying is it's one I want to read, not maybe it's from another, a submission from someone else.
Someone else.
Come in and we thought, this is good, isn't it? Yeah.
Just to build on something that you were saying and bringing it into the 21st century and us now, because it's all about looking backwards to look forwards.
Mm, yeah.
I feel, at the time, we were comfortable about playing adults. And I always remember that when we picked an age other than Traveller, where you acted, that was kind of part of the mechanics, built into the mechanics. And some other games, you determine the age through the mechanics. But very often where you picked an age, it was always like 22, 23.
Yeah.
It seemed very old.
quite mature. quite old, yeah.
However, now, right, we're knocking on 60, aren't we? You feel a bit uncomfortable if you're asked to do it the other way. So some of these games that are around now, like Tales from the Loop.
Yeah, play a kid.
Play a kid. And all the hang-ups that come with kids, and particularly someone like Monster Hearts.
Yeah,
there was a discussion about that because Monster Hearts deals with like the sexuality between
Things from the Flood's like that. So the sequel to Tales from the Loop, Things from the Flood, is a bit like that. And I must admit, you've run Things from the Flood a couple of times. But when I've run it, I've torn down all that element of it. But yeah, that talks about those kind of things because you're actually older teenagers, 16, 17, 18, 19 kind of thing. And it brings in all those kind of things that, as an adult, it's very slightly uncomfortable, don't you?
Think,
I don't know, I want to play a teenage boy who's got some, you know, hang-ups about, you know, the sexuality or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that, but I'm not sure I'm the right person to be playing in. I don't know.
Round a table with other people. And the So there we are at the extreme ends of this future article. As kids feeling uncomfortable playing adults and what the...
And now as adults, you're not uncomfortable playing child.
Yeah.
Even though I have been a child, but it was so long ago, it's just a vague memory. All I can remember is your red painted walls and your leaky bike lamp. All the other emotional trauma I've packed away, I don't want to revisit it in a game.
And put them in the drawers, but don't open.
Don't open the drawer, yeah, because I left a phone now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Put a phone, your thoughts, your memories in that drawer, don't open it.
Yeah.
Yeah, just play Dungeon Crawl Classics and fight monsters. Nothing more complicated than that. Thank you very much. That would be my feature article, but signed off, someone much cleverer than me. And maybe a bit older.
Yeah. Okay, you've got one bit of gameable content to deliver.
One bit of gameable content. Oh,
now at the weekend we're going to be playing Corum, Stormbringer at MorpCon, and I'm struggling with one aspect of it, which I've never struggled with before, and I never did back in that bedroom in 1983, and that's making up a monster. Making up a monster is really hard. I want to design a monster that's fitting in the world, but make it a bit more interesting. Because in the spirit of Moorcock, making it unusual and having to kind of describe it, referring to something that exists, but it's being...
Or do you find you think of something and go, oh, that's just like a manticore.
Yes.
Oh, that's just like a basilisk. Oh, that's just like a hydra. Oh, it's all been done.
It's all been done. It has all been done
to the ancient Greeks and the monsters. You've done it all. Why?
And I'm sure that we've discussed this before, but you always end up like making something big. It's something that exists in the world big. Like the badger, as we
mentioned. A giant badger.
A giant badger, for example.
Yeah.
Or you end up hybridizing a badger with a goat.
Yeah.
Or some such. And you can't really get out of that. Or you make something that is so monstrous and not of this world that it becomes like H.P. Lovecraft. It
becomes like a shoggoth.
Yeah, I've stuck a shoggoth.
You realise you've stuck a shoggoth in it. You're intensive,
but you have. There must be some way of creating a monster.
Well, there are some games that have tables. I mean, DCC has a table for creating monsters.
Has it?
I think I recently got Shadow Dark, and that has some. So there are some games that do have little tables in to create monsters.
Mm. Yeah. So what does that do, say, like...
Well, you just said roll, and for what it looks like, roll for special ability, roll for this, that, you know, and it kind of gives you a I suppose, stick some ideas together for you.
Yeah.
I think DC has one for, like, I think it's for demons as well, it's got one where... But whether that is really what you're after, I don't know. You probably roll on the table, like, oh, no, I don't like that. Roll again.
So it's a work in progress. And what's the deadline for this magazine? Might never come by then.
Might never come.
But I'll work on this month.
Next week, because that, at the time, in the 80s, that descent seemed like a lifetime.
next Tuesday. So I'm making a monster, but you might have to wait for it.
Making a monster. Yeah. I don't know what game of a concept when I put in. You see, I think now, as we said earlier, the game of content I'd like is a nice little scenario that I would read and think, oh, that's quite cool. That's quite clever. That's quite cool. But I'd run that. But back then, I don't think that's what I would have. I wouldn't have necessarily considered gameable content then.
Yeah,
I would probably come up with like a cult for RuneQuest, wouldn't I, or something like that? Yeah. Imagine doing something like that.
I did.
The last thing I would do now. It's the last thing I would do now.
Yeah. Well, I did do that. I do you remember Marthian Chronicles.
Mm.
The Marthian Chronicles. Now, this isn't going to be in Mike's list of stuff for Granta because I think there were only about 500 produced. But it was a friend we met in York, was that
right? Yeah.
And he produced a fanzine. Yeah. And he put my Cult of Athquil for Rackclass in there.
Yeah.
And my scenario with Holmlock Shells and Nodled Duck.
Oh, and the Daldius Quack.
Nadaldi's Quack.
Nadaldi's Quack. My duck detective. There you go. You see detectives again.
Yeah. I think there's still room for scenarios. I want to say the one pager, but they're always...
I'm never convinced by them.
Never convinced by them.
I'm never convinced. Why are you obsessed with fitting it on a page? You can use more than one page. It's not like, we're not going to hold it against you.
Yeah.
You could have 4 or 5 pages if you want.
Yeah.
In a one page scenario. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But there are, out there, if you go in Hipchar on...
Yeah, there's loads of stuff.
There's loads of stuff.
There's loads of
stuff. And there are some real gems in there.
Yeah,
so you can get it for old school essentials and stuff like that. But how do you find the ones
that... I know, and that's the problem. How do you find the ones that are any good? Is what you get is people say... And I've bought things that people say in the reviews. Oh, it's brilliant, it's brilliant. But I know it's not.
Yeah.
You know, and then you find others that you think, oh, this is really good. But there's no real way of knowing, is there?
No.
Until you've got it and you're either going to go, that's great, or no, it's not. Disappointing. Yeah.
And that's why I think you need magazines, because it's all very well to say there's all that content out there on the web.
Curation of it.
Curation of it.
Someone has decided. If you trust the editor, you trust the person curating it, you're okay, I trust you. You've picked some good scenarios and good things before, so I'm assuming it'll be good again.
There is something to be said for something that pulls together stuff that's on that itch and on drive through and pulls it together once every quarter and says, these are our selection of the content.
Yeah.
And put it out as an actual magazine, a physical magazine that you can hold.
Because there is a bewildering amount of stuff out there. You go on drive through, loads and loads of stuff in there, loads of like system agnostic stuff. And if you're looking for something to run, it becomes a bit bewildering at times, a bit, or you just think, oh, for God's sake, I don't know, I'll give up. You know, write your own.
Yeah.
But at the time, I spent looking for something, I could have written me own.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's good. So you're doing a little scenario.
Well, yeah. No, I'm doing a cult for RuneQuest.
call for inquest.
I wouldn't do a scenario now. Are we talking about then? If we're talking about then, I would do something like a call for inquest.
Yeah.
Because that was our obsession, wasn't it? Inquest was our obsession of cults of cults of
practice.
I used to love cults of practice. You know?
Yeah. I was not quite convinced by your submission.
You're judging me now because you know I've got a bit of a gripe against Runequest. But not then. You wouldn't have said that then.
No, that's true.
You wouldn't, would you? It's like, yeah.
What's that cult of? Goats and badgers.
Giant badgers.
Yeah.
Giant badger cult.
Giant badgers. Okay. So this is the best bit, Nate.
Okay.
We've got some correspondence.
Okay, letters page.
This is the letters page.
Who the editors have to respond.
Yeah, editors have to respond. So we've asked the Grog Squad to write in as if they're writing in from 1983.
Right, okay.
All right.
And it was really interesting.
Okay. Dear Dirk and Blythe, that's us. We weren't known as that then, were we?
I was kind of known as Blythe, wasn't I?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I was known as Chart at that
Charter, yeah.
Charter.
Yeah. People would be puzzled by that.
Yeah, Charty.
Don't explain. Don't apologise. Don't explain for it.
Yeah. Dear Charty and Blackwell, I'm hoping to go to university this September. Well done.
Well done. What's a university? Well, at the time, we would have said, what's a university?
Yeah.
So any West?
Well, that's something that other people...
That's a lot of the people going to university. Yeah. Not us. That cost caps and pasties.
Hey, go on. Dad, what's a university?
Our cloth caps and pasties and dying industry. Yes. And permanent unemployment staring us. Anyway, go on.
What's a university? Never you mind.
Don't you worry about that.
Get to work.
Get a job in a factory. Yeah. There aren't any. They're all shut. Oh, in that case, go to university then.
My mother just caught me reading Apple Lane.
What are you going to say then?
Instead of doing A-level revision, she looked at the book in disgust and said, you need to grow up. If you get to university, you won't find anyone who wants to play baboon games. Please, could you advise me how I should reply to her? And that's from Simon in Middlesbrough. Goat Major. Now, it's like an agony aunt.
Say they're not...
It's an agony.
They're not baboons. And these are not just games.
Yeah.
That's the answer, isn't it?
I found myself in that position. I probably... When I left school for... reasoned, unknown to myself and you, we both did the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
We went doing business studies, didn't we?
We did. Yeah. I think we were slightly seduced by Margaret Thatcher's entrepreneurial.
Yes.
Given that she shut all the factories, apart from Vantona, which was a knicker factory, wasn't it? Where they would recruit like loads of girls from, do you remember?
They
come to school and all these girls go on going working at Vantona and you think, well, the knicker industry thriving? But, you know, like everything else is dying by its own.
It was slightly sinister, wasn't it? Like Logan's Run.
Yeah, it was like cult, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to Vantona. You are? What the hell's that?
They would come in, wouldn't they, careers and they would do presentations.
Yeah.
To Vantona and make knickers. Anyway, so
we did business studies because we fought for about 5 minutes.
We had to do something.
We had to do something, didn't we? When you're being offered YTS in Grimsby on a stroller, business studies is a better option.
I would say that I failed that year because I got nothing out of that year.
Yeah, I didn't get anything out of that year.
Because of role-playing games.
I would, but I would also say I didn't get anything out of that year because it was very boring.
Yeah.
It wasn't really me. And when you think of when we did go to university, the subjects we both did are about as far removed from business studies as you could possibly get.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was all role-playing fault. I think it was also, it was really boring.
It was really boring. But what you could say is that we were getting an education through role-playing games.
Of course, yeah.
Because it was expanding our hinterland of
course, interest. Yeah, of course.
And we were... investigating things like history and literature.
Yeah, I would also say to Goat Major, I'd say to ask his mum, how do you know there's baboons in these games? Because I'd say that's not immediately apparent.
She's been reading them.
She's been reading them, hasn't she?
Yeah.
She's been, I'd challenge her there. I'd say, well, how do you know? Because it's not immediately apparent. At a cursory glance at the RuneQuest second edition rules and Apple Lair, I'd say it's not immediately apparent there's baboons in it. Well, there's a quite, you can question the questioner there, I don't measure.
Dear Mr. Dice and Mr. Blythe,
mm.
For my birthday this year, my mummy and daddy took me to
How old is this person pretending to be? Mummy and daddy?
I don't know. I might be quite young because I have a readership. He's a cross-section of
age. Okay. Isn't it? All right. Fair enough.
My mummy and daddy took me to see Return of the Jedi at the cinema. I had my two best friends with me. We loved the movie. It was ace. We've been playing lots of games of Star Wars with our new action figures, but we're running out of ideas. I'm sad that Darth Vader died. I liked him. I'm also sad that there'll be no more Star Wars.
Grow up and play some baboon games. That's the answer to that one.
Could you recommend some games for us to play to keep our dreams alive? And that's from Christian F. I remember seeing Return of the Jedi.
Mm.
And when I saw it, I felt privileged. Do you know why I felt privileged?
Why you feel privileged?
Because I felt we could emulate what happened in.
Yeah, you felt like all the other muggles in the cinema couldn't do that, but you could leave and go, I'm going to recreate this.
Playing this world. Yeah. All the things like the Rancor monster.
Yeah.
Was brilliant.
Yeah.
So the Rancor monster, you were instantly statting it out in your head, weren't you?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Thinking, oh, I'm going to put that in.
Oh, you'd be a bit, at that time, you'd be a bit earnest about the fact that he used a big femur bone to fight with him. You know, I don't think the odds are on the Rancor monster.
Yeah. Yeah. As Luke's got, we got the strength to pick that up and wield it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, I'm
sorry about that. It's only going to do D4 damage anyway.
Yeah.
It's still like, save us being E.
So, I mean, we are going to do a episode on Star Wars, aren't we?
At this time, did the Star Wars role-playing game exist?
I don't think
it did. It did. It came a bit a few years later. So your only option there is to play a traveller.
Yeah.
Or space opera, but I suspect.
Yeah, space
opera. Might scramble your brain because it's so complicated. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are going to do an episode on Star Wars at some point, but we've been building this one for 3 years and we're reluctant to do it, aren't we?
Because it's too big a topic, doesn't it?
It's a big topic.
Yeah, it is.
And it's something that's very close to our hearts.
Mm. But it's closer to other people's.
Yes.
That's your problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. We love Star Wars as a massive part of our life, but there are other people who love it more than we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, once we start talking about it, will we cause offence? That's the worry, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think my advice to him is go and buy Traveller and try and emulate Star Wars with it and fail like I did. But it'd be too late then because you'll be bitten by the bug. And even though Traveller won't emulate Star Wars, you still won't be able to stop playing it.
Dear Dirk and Blythe, I also play RuneQuest down in Essex. I've heard of Manchester in our geography O-level classes. It sounds like an interesting place. Chaosium has just released Pavis and the Big Rubble box sets. They're amazing. I heard that Chaosium has signed a deal with Avalon Hill to publish RuneQuest. I'd really like to get your thoughts on that. It should be great, right? Thanks, Peter from Essex.
Avalon Hill RuneQuest.
Avalon Hill. Well, they're going to do it. Mm. So this was a point, wasn't it, where there was a lot of excitement about Avalon Hill getting into the role-playing games. And I think we've talked before about Powers and Perils. Do you remember that one? Powers and Perils.
It was
build up like this is going to be like a panacea of role playing.
Yeah.
And we didn't get it because we couldn't afford these things. We didn't get a Big Rumble.
No. Can't afford. But I remember, I have a vivid memory of seeing the Avalon Hill RuneQuest box set and being like astonished at the price of it.
Yeah. But even if you go back to Big Rubble and Pavis, it goes back to my feature article, Peter from Essex. In my feature article, I looked at them and I thought, has it got scenarios in it? They're not linked scenarios. They're like, it's like a picture of a city. And I felt like I'd had my fingers burnt with 12 pack, which was all very interesting to me. But what was I meant to do with it?
Yeah, that was true, that, because you were really taken with weird with 12 pack. I remember being, again, kind of envious because Traveller didn't have anything similar.
Yeah.
Not like that then. It didn't have anything that really went into these alien races or anything like that. I remember the guy saying, great. But then, like you say, you didn't really run anything with it because you didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
It was just like, but what do I do with this? From a gameable perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it had scenarios in it, but they just felt like, hey, do you want these?
Yeah.
And I think similarly, with Pavis and Big Robot, what's there? I love the covers. I love the idea of them, but they were expensive. And I thought, I'm not going to be burnt again.
Yeah.
What I want is Borderlands. I want Seven Adventures.
Seven Adventures. Yeah, that, you know it's going to be, yeah, seven rollable adventures. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But they just were very expensive. They have them in the old box set. I don't know how much it was.
It was about 30 quid, wasn't it, all told?
Yeah. But in those days, everyone, that was a lot of money.
It was,
you know. Now it seems ludicrous that would be an off-putting price, but I think at the time it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, 7-8 quid was felt like a lot of money.
It wasn't like Room Quest box set, like $7.99 or $8.99 or something. That was like almost a tenner, which was quite a lot. And then this came along, and it was 30-odd, 40 quid. It just seemed like, oof,
one more.
All right.
Hi, Dirk. Long-time reader, first-time writer. I'm a big movie fan. Do you think that we'll ever see role-playing games that are dedicated to a particular film or TV series? I'd love a game in the Star Wars universe or play as Indiana Jones or maybe capture ghosts as a member of the Ghostbusters franchise. I'd even play a game based on the Planet of the Apes or the films Alien and Blade Runner. Enjoy the show. Keep up the good work. Mike.
Well, just you wait, little Mike. It's all coming your way. Give it 40 years. They'll all be there for you, won't it?
You'll have so many you won't want
to. You'll have so many. So many that you won't want to do. Yeah.
And you'll get to the point where you think, why didn't I just do this with something else?
Yeah. It's funny, though, that question, isn't it? Because, of course, some of the things he mentions there would soon appear, wouldn't they?
All of them, yeah.
You know, would soon appear, and then other things are going to be a bit later, aren't they?
Yeah.
But what's kind of interesting about that, I think, is at the time, we were very sniffy about that, weren't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
We were very sniffy. We played Ghostbusters with
Mike.
Somebody else will call Mike. He might be a bit older. And it was really good. It was a really good game. And I was amazed how good it was, given that it was kind of an old game.
Yeah.
But at the time, I think we were a bit, I'm not playing like Ghostbusters. No, I cramped my imagination, my credible imagination, because I'm recreating Return of the Jedi in my own way. So, and it was like the Indiana Jones game. That was, that was a bit panned, wasn't it, by critics?
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff like that. So,
mainly because they put trademark on Nazis, didn't they?
Yeah, trademark on Nazis.
Yeah, remember they had TSL were obsessed with putting TM on it.
Yeah, they did. Oh, I know they were. Yeah, yeah. Trademark on Nazis. It's a pity that Nazis aren't trademarked, because then you could stop them doing it. Breach your trademark. Stop doing that. Anyway,
but there was always this feeling that, and you still hear it today, to be honest.
Mm.
This idea that, well, indie couldn't die, therefore.
Yeah.
Where's the fun in that?
Yeah, where's the fun in it? Yeah.
People say it now, though, versus, you can't die very easily.
Yeah, you can't die, so what's the point? But we played games. We played Tales from the Loop, and in Tales from the Loop, you literally can't die.
Yeah.
And as I always say, one of the funniest things about that game, you know, I ran it, first game I ran of it, it was around two sessions for you in edit, and in Tales from the Loop, you can't die. You just become broken. So the worst thing that can happen to you as a kid is that you become broken, you fail the scenario, and it's resolved in some other way by law enforcement or whatever. And we were on the one with dinosaurs, didn't we? That comes through the time portal. And you fail. You both failed and were broken. I've never seen you more pissed off.
Exactly.
If you'd have been killed, you'd have bothered. Well, the fact you failed.
There'd been some glory in that.
There'd be some glory, yeah. But you failed. What happens there? Was he just sorted out by other kids and the police? Oh, right. So they, like you said, the idea that you can't, you might be able to die, but you can fail, can't you?
Yeah. But a lot of these film franchise ones that came around that time were trying to, the Star Wars one to some extent and Ghostbusters, you start to get this idea of story in it, didn't they? To try to reconcile that it was less procedural, like Dungeon.
Yeah.
And a bit more open and narrative. And
Yeah.
There we go. Well, that has got a lot to look forward to, Mike.
It'd be great magazine. Great fanzine, this, in your imagination.
Yeah. Right, there we go. I think we've got enough there, haven't we?
I think so.
I think we can staple that, eh?
Get it on the old photocopy at the VJ shop.
Yeah.
Or one of those Banda machines, remember that? The purple things, the purple ink, the smelly, weird stuff.
Well, that in that VJ shop we used to go.
VJ shop, people are wondering, what's a VJ shop? It was just called the VJ shop, wasn't it?
It was.
What did VJ stand
for? I don't know.
I don't know to this day.
I think we said veteran gnomes.
We used to call it the veteran gnome shop, but that was, I mean, it obviously wasn't that. if it was, and someone knows, I'd be amazed. But yeah, I don't know what it was really stood for.
We used to go to the VG store. We were the only people who used the photocopier.
Yeah.
Because they used to have to take all the beans off it, didn't
they? Well, he advertised a photocopying service in the window. And yet, when you went in with any photocopier, he looked incredibly irritated that you asked for photocopying. And you probably say, well, stop advertising it. Get rid of your copier, you miserable old git. Why are you doing that? He was like really put out by it, wasn't it?
Yeah, he could see his eyes literally rolling.
And he's like, oh, here they come. Here they come. The weird sheets that they don't understand. They want like 10 copies of a RuneQuest character sheet or something like that.
Yeah,
he did. It really annoyed him.
I think he got that pink paper just to put us off.
Yeah, possibly. But he didn't.
It just
wouldn't be defeated.
We're still here today.
We're still here
40
today.
40-odd years later.
The paper did put us off. That's the VG shop. Yeah. What was he called?
Oh, I don't
remember his name.
No.
It wasn't VJ. It wasn't like Vernon Green. It wasn't his name that was VJ. I don't know what it stood for.
So, right, let's put it in there. And can you remember the title?
Talkamada Meet Doom.
There we go.
Yeah.
It's landing on your doorstep in your imaginations.
Best place for it.
Thanks, Blythe. Goodbye.
All right, this Cowie Norland Vexes Gaming Vexes or whatever it is.
Thanks for the intro, Dave. I'm Steve, host of All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes, a podcast documenting my ongoing mission to run or at least play all of the RPGs that I seem to be incapable of stopping myself buying.
And you'll see me frequently fiddling with something in my hands.
Each episode, I get together with a group of fellow gamers that have either played a game I've run or who've GM'd a game for me. We chat through what we've enjoyed about the game and some ways we could have improved the experience whilst making a series of terrible jokes along the way.
Was it hot chat action?
Sometimes we con game designers who really should know better to come along and talk to us about their games and maybe run an actual play segment to give us an idea of their vision for their game.
I've told this story before, I won't bore anyone.
Our topics range from old school favourites like RuneQuest through to some of those newfangled narrative games all the cool kids talk about. When you listen, I want you to feel as though you're sitting around our gaming table, taking part in our post-game chat and helping dispose of the last of the crisps and ale.
I'll just wax my bowstring and think about the death of the tainted.
Oh no, 898.
So, if you like listening to people droning on excitedly about games in a range of regional British accents, All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes is the pod for you, and you'll find it on your podcasting app of choice. On occasion, you may even hear something really insightful, but I'm making no promises. Over to you, Dave.
Point to Ponxes and make it a Titan.
Keep it high.
There is another bit. Thanks to John for appearing at Virtual Grog Meet. There is actually more of that, and it's been included in Dirk's dossier. You should also make sure that you get hold of a copy of Weird Science. The new issue is particularly brilliant, I'd say, and well worth investing your time and money into getting hold of a copy. I've put a link in the show notes to where you can get one. Now, at the time of recording, it's bank holiday Monday here in the UK, and it's blistering with heat, so the perfect time for me to be holed up in the den talking to you and preparing for UK Games Expo, which is next weekend in Birmingham. And normally when that finishes, my mind starts to think of grog meat. Hang on a minute, but I can hear you say, haven't you already had grog meet this year? Well, that's right. Back in January, we had a meet-up in Manchester. However, we're going to have another one in November. You'll be able to see on the grognardfiles.com for details, but we're actually changing location just to test out Preston in a bid to try and restore some of that feeling that we had 10 years ago when we started afresh and everything seemed unfamiliar and different. It also gives people who can't get to Manchester an opportunity to try a different city. As I say, more details can be found in the grognardfiles.com, and the best way to keep you up to date with any of this is to follow us on Patreon. Thank you to all those who chip in every month to make sure that this show stays on the road. It's that time of year when there's a few bills come in for hosting costs, etc. So it's good to know that we've got the backup of the Grog Squad chipping in a few coins each month to keep it going. If you've backed us in the past, and or if you're continuing to back us now, it is really appreciated. Thank you, especially in this cash-strapped times. We did actually have quite a lot more correspondence for the Thunder Page copy of the 1983 fanzine. I'm pretty sure that you'd like to hear our responses to those, wouldn't you? I'll include it in an extra episode that we'll put out, just us looking back over our experiences at UK Games Expo this year. So until then, adios, amigos.